Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Welcome to The Ruck. I don't know if you can hear the sound of lawnmowers in the background or indeed the clipped rhythm of knives cutting cucumber sandwiches. Where are we, Alex?
We're at Pennyhill Park.
That was Ruck regular rugby fashionista Alex Lowe. I'm Owen Slot. And we have a return to the podcast from Alex Spink, the rugby correspondent at the Daily Mirror. Spinky, great to have you back.
Thank you, Slotty. The last time I did one of these outside broadcasts, I have to say it was in the Angel Hotel in Cardiff with a well-known radio station. And there was someone sitting behind the man with the microphone, clinking cutlery together and glasses together. So when we talk about the grass being cut, etc., in this instance, obviously we mean it quite truthfully.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, the lawnmower's working hard behind us. So we are not in our London studios. We've gone on location today to Pennyhill Park, where the England team have long been based. Always struck me as a little peculiar or quaint, if you like. You get a room here for £300. And to give you an idea of the sort of place it is, the blurb from their website has an abundance of individually styled bedrooms and suites, a luxury spa, award-winning dining experiences. We make it an ultimate destination for all occasions, a five-star break, international conference. Your dream wedding, Alex, a pampering spa day, afternoon tea with the girls, Spinky, or a romantic dinner for two, or indeed trying to win a Grand Slam or a World Cup. Do we think that this is one of the ultimate training centres in world sport?
Yeah, it certainly is. And it's actually got a pretty decent history of being the hub of World Cup successes. England obviously formulated their plans here in 2003. And I remember talking to Tendai Mtawira, the Springbok prop, 2015, when the Springboks moved in here after England had been eliminated. He said it was the best training facility that he'd ever experienced. There's a scrum garden that Graham Rowntree put in. There's an indoor training pitch, half size, massive gym. And the field here is of Twickenham standards. So that's a pretty decent endorsement from the Beast.
Everyone who stayed here in 2015, the other teams who came here, like you said, South Africa, they all were raving about it as a great place to come and train. Spinky, how did England actually come to be here in the first place?
Well, funny you should mention South Africa, because the Southern Hemisphere actually discovered this as a rugby venue before England did. 1999 World Cup, England bombed out in the quarterfinals, leaving the way free for Australia to go on and win it. And Australia based themselves here, and Clive Woodward, as he was then, saw the venue, saw the facilities, and thought, right, well, if it's good enough for Australia to win a World Cup, we're going to have it. And obviously, 4 years on, his team won the World Cup based here.
Spinky, you've covered a lot of different sports. You've been to a lot of different training venues around the world. You've seen where elite sport happens. Where else have you seen that compares to this?
Well, I mean, I do agree with everyone that this is probably, you know, right up there at the very top level in terms of the facilities available, the resources. The RFU have got bottomless pockets, so you know everything they need they get here, which is wonderful. I just kind of contrast it slightly. I remember going a couple of years ago. I went to the top of the Pyrenees to seek out Mo Farah training prior to one of his many Olympic successes in Fontremer, and we got up there and it was just literally this kind of Spartan block of flats, and we waited for him. He came out of his flat, went for about his 17th run of the day, came back around the corner, and we said, where should we meet? Is there a kind of high performance place we can meet, you know, somewhere to chat? And he said, no, it's just a little ice cream bar down the corner. into which we went, and you could hardly get a seat because there were just tourists everywhere. We sat down ready to do an interview. Somebody who was with us, who was taking us there, said, can we get you some food? And we said, yeah, that'd be lovely. And so midway through the interview with this Olympic champion, the greatest athlete that Britain has ever produced, we were handed ice creams. And it was, the temperature must have been about 40 degrees. And so I have a picture at home sitting opposite Mo Farah, Sir Mo Farah as he is now, with strawberry ice cream trickling down my arm as we spoke. So I say, it's a far cry from what England have here. We don't get ice creams here yet.
For me, have either of you guys been to the new Racing training centre in south of Paris? That is outstanding. That was built for purpose from scratch. So they've got all the different types of pitches that they need. They have a dormitory there for their academicians, and they have a small school on site as well. So for me, that's about as elite as it gets, especially in club rugby.
Yeah, I think probably in world sport, the top end, you'd always look at the NFL teams because they've got huge money and they need space because they've got so many players, and that is the best of the best. And if you could equate this to an NFL camp, I mean, the NFL teams come and stay here when they play at Twickenham and at Wembley, so if it's good enough for them, then I think it'd be pretty clear that it's one of the best around.
I think when the NFL came to play at Twickenham most recently, I think they had to knock down a couple of the RFU committee rooms just to build a bigger changing room for themselves. So I think the esteemed Eric room was knocked to pieces. All the pitches came down. They built their changing room for 1 week and then rebuilt the Eric room.
Okay, excellent. So listen, on this point of elite training centres, we now have joined us on the podcast someone who knows even more than Alex Spinkey and myself on this subject. Dean Benton, Head of Sports Science for England, is coming to give his own opinions on the very subject. Dean, you've worked for a fair few number of sporting outfits, the Wallabies, the Japan rugby team, French rugby, Melbourne Storm Rugby League, Netball Australia, the swimmer Stephanie Rice, 3 gold medals.
Correct, yes.
Brisbane Broncos, Leicester Tigers, Australia Institute of Sport and the Queensland Institute of Sport. So you've seen a lot of different sporting environments. So we're talking about Penny Hill Park as an elite training centre. And from what you've seen around the world with all these manifold experiences, how do you compare this to other places you've been in?
Well, I'd probably divide it in terms of professional sports and Olympic sport. That's 5 big centres around the world. Obviously, you've got Loughborough, you've got the Australian Institute of Sport, Leipzig in Germany, US Olympic Training Centre, and now Aspire recently. They're probably the premier facilities in terms of Olympic sports.
That's Aspire in Qatar, yeah?
Yes. However, in terms of professional sports, I would have to say that Penny Hill now is probably the best I've seen. It's very functional, allows us to train the way that we want to train in a very integrated fashion. So we have a nice blend of indoor and outdoor facilities, to which I'm sure you guys have seen. And now it enables us to vary our training and to do more training and to be even at times aggressive with our training, given the short spaces of time that we have with the players.
Do you find it a slightly bizarre, slightly quaint mix that you have this elite sports team and rubbing shoulders with people coming away for away days or a nice dinner for two or a wedding even? Is that a bit peculiar, or is that sort of part of the character of it?
Well, I suppose we have a mix of times when we're very serious and intense, and Eddie's very good at taking, the pressure off things, and there's times when we socialise together as a squad and a staff, and I think it's a nice mix with that.
And for you, any sort of personal favourites about being in this hotel? Any parts of the training facility or anything on the pudding trolley even?
I'd have to say, look, I've been, I suppose, instrumental in, along with Eddie, in terms of creating some of the new facilities here, so I'm partial to all of them, really. So, as I said, that the indoor facility enables us to do a lot more. Its proximity to the gym is fantastic. And, of course, we have a lot of different types of facilities of different nature outside, so we can vary and blend our training and do a lot more training as a result.
The idea of a cryotherapy centre is one that other teams have used, and England have had mobile cryotherapy come in from time to time. Is that something that you would like more permanently, or would that be a way forward?
We use it quite judiciously. With some players like it, it's not a one size fit all. We're quite varied with our recovery modes. So yeah, it's just one tool in the toolbox for us.
in this Six Nations, we seem to be in a championship where the battle of fitness has been talked about considerably already, especially in the lead up to the Wales game. There was talk about we're fitter than you, we're fitter than you, etc. So given your experience with all these different teams and athletes that you've worked with, how do you see England at the moment on that strata of fittest teams in the world, which is what they need to be for the World Cup?
Well, of course I'm going to be biased if we're talking about fitness. So, however, in saying that, I would have to say that the England team are the best prepared in that regard that I've seen, and by far, in terms of specificity of fitness, without doubt, the fittest team I've worked with.
That's based on any particular parameters or the whole picture?
Observations, knowing how they compare to other historical data to which I'm familiar with experience. I think we're only scratching the surface of where we can go. We're certainly nowhere near as fit as we can be, and that's going to be a journey towards the World Cup.
So compared, say, to the Wallabies, who you worked with in the build-up to the last World Cup, you say this England team is now considerably ahead of that?
Of course, comparing to those, what would be 2 years ago, of course.
So the whole game's moved on considerably quite quickly then?
Absolutely. It moves on all the time. It's quite dramatic. But look, I won't speak about direct comparisons with teams.
Sure.
And compare testing data. I'll direct you guys to how we performed in the last 20 and our scoring profile.
You talked about the facilities that you've been involved in putting in here. I don't know how many you're comfortable talking about, but there's a ramp that's been installed in the far side of the pitch. Is that for literally mauling uphill, or?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about the ramp. Obviously, it's nothing revelatory. There's a few that exist around the world. There's one at Dallas Cowboys, University of Oregon have them. We use it for speed. We use to do some mauling up there, and some other training modalities. We'll also point out, like, whilst we're very fortuitous to have some fantastic facilities here, it doesn't take the place of good quality coaching, and that's where we place our main emphasis.
James Huskell's not shy of a gym or a training session, but he was telling us at Twickenham on Friday that was the toughest training session that he'd ever been through. He said that you keep changing the clock, or whether it just felt like that, but he said you keep changing the clock so they never know how long they've got left. But also, he talked about the integrated sessions that you just mentioned. Could you just explain what that means? Presumably kind of running from a bench press to a wrestling mat, or could you just talk us through the shape of a training session?
Quite simply, that everything we do is directed towards the game plan. And obviously it's quite well documented. He's talked about tactical periodization. And everything we do in the gym is directed towards how we want to play. So it's not like the old days of squat, bench and chin and a very segregated way of training. It's very integrated.
One thing that you mentioned from previous work, you worked with the Japan Rugby World Cup team leading up to the last World Cup as well. You mentioned, on talking about Japan, that they had pioneered new performance paradigms for that World Cup. Can you explain that a bit more, and where would England currently sit on against those, against Japan 2015 in comparison?
Very different situation. Obviously, Eddie applied tactical periodization with Japan very successfully. Again, culturally, tactically, physically, very different situations. And he's simply, that's the genius in Eddie. He could recognise different cultures, different physiological makeups of players, and he adapts, I suppose, his systems to different situations, and he's done that. I think he's superseded what he's done with Japan already, and I still think there's a whole new level to come as well.
That's really interesting. Can you explain that a bit? Culturally, what would he be doing with English, with an England rugby team, versus what he could have done with Japan? I think we sort of have a very vague idea, but could you explain that a bit more, and how he could have taken it even further?
Yeah, like, for instance, with the Japanese players, they're not shy of work, and they'd be happy to train very, very long hours. England players probably are different in terms of they want to train for shorter periods and more intensely. So you've got to take into account, I suppose, different. The Japanese players weren't big, they weren't particularly fast. So Eddie took an approach with the backs, to get them to be highly skilled and be able to play fast. He obviously has different cattle here, and we prepare them slightly differently.
you say that there's a lot more improvement still to come. Is that only something that you can do in that period between the end of the 2019 domestic season and the World Cup, where you have a big window there? Or is that something that we're going to see gradually between in the next 18 months?
Probably more the latter, gradually. We have a philosophy of staff and players are getting better every day. And the players, you know, are very good. They spend 70% of the time with their clubs and 30% with us. And even with their clubs, they continually improve. And, of course, when they're with us, they do the same. So, yeah, it'd be more a gradual improvement.
Fittest player in the squad?
Oh, I'll be declined to comment on that one. They're all very hard-working young lads.
Okay. Fittest coach in the squad?
Oh, definitely Paul Gustard. Yeah. Yeah, he trains like a demon. So, you know, he loves his gym work.
All right. Well, Steve Borthwick will be interested to hear that later. But thanks very much for joining us. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Really interesting, I think, what you were saying about the unequivocal saying England were the fittest, and yet there was still room to improve. So, Calcutta Cup on Saturday, is that yet another reason to believe England should win? Where are you on that, Alex?
It certainly feeds into England's confidence going up there. I mean, Scotland are a team who want to play fast, open rugby, and I think England would back themselves to stick with them at a high-paced game. They would also back themselves to grind one out if the conditions are as they have been in previous Calcutta Cup matches up there. I think the Wales game, England failed to kick on at key times when you thought they could have won by more, but I think they're a team that is showing with the base level fitness that they have that they can win either way, and that puts them in a very good position going up to face a Scotland team who are going to probably want to come out and keep a very high tempo, because I don't think they can match England's tight five and the sort of the grunt and grind that's going to be necessary.
This isn't an England team that is putting opponents to the sword through 80 minutes. They're outlasting them, I think, three times in the last four or five games. They've scored three tries in the last 12, 15 minutes to pull away from sides. I mean, you know, they are not destroying teams across 80 minutes.
What we really want then is a proper competitive Calcutta Cup. Do you think, Spinky, that we are on the verge of that? Because personally, my frustration with the England-Scotland fixture is it is so rarely competitive, and I struggle to remember the last time I was at Murrayfield and I was on the edge of my seat.
Well, that's very true. I mean, even games that have been won by either team up there have rarely been thrilling. I mean, I was trying to think back through the great England-Scotland occasions. 1990 obviously sprung to mind with Thatcher and the poll tax and all the kind of peripheral chat which went into before that game, which led Scotland to produce that kind of superhuman performance and send the English home to think again. I mean, after that, you look at 1996, Dean Richards, a one-man demolition crew when England won at Murrayfield. But prior to that, since then, Scotland have won a couple of times, but there have been some really drab encounters, seriously drab encounters.
Even there was a draw in 2010, 15-all, which couldn't have been. It was bizarre for a test match to end in a draw. Couldn't have been less thrilling or exciting. It was a drab, one-paced, one-dimensional encounter. And you're right, Sotty, about the. This should be one of the great, exciting fixtures. And Eddie Jones rather poo-pooed the Scots for their performance last year, where they came to Twickenham everyone was proclaiming them as the great entertainers, and they got a hiding at Twickenham. And I think he was rather putting the pressure on them heading into this tournament, because people were saying much the same because of the way that they beat Australia, the way they pushed New Zealand, but they haven't shown it yet this championship. And I think England will go there with confidence, but I don't go there with much confidence that it's going to be one of the great occasions, which is what England-Scotland games should be and what you'd like them to be.
Best thing that's happened to this fixture is Wales burying Scotland on the opening weekend, because Scotland came into the championship on a real bounce after putting 50 points past Australia, and everyone thought there could be serious challenges. And people kind of detailed reasons why they could be. Gregor Townsend, brilliant tactical guy, knows how to bring the best out of his team, etc., etc. Wales just wiped them out in that game, and kind of Scotland were overconfident, believed their own hype. And yet, when you strip all that away and you see that they've beaten France last time out, you kind of, it takes us back to what we thought of Scotland before the championship. You know, they are again a dangerous side that on their day, if they don't get carried away with themselves, can pose this England team problems. Now, that's not to say they're going to win it, because I think England are on a different level, but they are a dangerous team, and England will need to respect them. Otherwise, we'll revisit 2000 and 1990 all over again.
And as you say, we all coughed up all these reasons why Scotland were bouncing back, why Scotland were going to be the new force in the Six Nations. And one of those reasons was Finn Russell, who was the linchpin of this whole exciting new game that Gregor Townsend has had them playing. And he's probably the most disappointing player across all six teams at the moment. Without him there, so there's a talk about, you know, he was taken off with 17 minutes to go against France, and Greg Laidlaw saw it out. Without him there, or without him in form, is there really a game plan for Scotland to win this one?
I think Finn Russell's problem last week was they've got themselves into a mindset where they need to try everything all the time. They look for the miracle pass, the miracle play all the time, because that's how they've had their success. That's how they've beaten teams. And I think at times in certain matches, it doesn't call for that. And that's where, going back to what we're saying about England, if England need to produce something, then they've got the capability to do it. But if they just need to be pragmatic and sensible, they can switch that on as well, which is what we saw against Wales. So I'd be surprised if they drop Finn Russell, because he's so important to them. And if they play the way I think they'll want to play, with tempo and to get England's defence moved around, then he's really important to that. His link with Stuart Hogg is important to that. But I think Finn Russell, you know, anything less than a year ago, there was uproar that he wasn't on the Lions tour. And now he's being replaced early in a test match. They can move their scrum half to manage the game better. And that's what he needs to improve upon, I'd say, if they're going to have any chance of beating England.
You would also say that looking at the Scotland-France game a couple of weeks ago, I mean, France handed that game to Scotland. You know, Scotland played well and they came back into the game well, but France had built themselves a platform to win the game, and they just evaporated in the second half. They were absolutely shocking. And what you know with England is that their base level is so much higher than that. Even if they get everything wrong, nothing comes off, you know their base level is going to be way above that. So Scotland are going to beat England, they're going to have to win the game. It won't be handed to them at all.
France, as you say, were shocking in the second half of that game, and then they decided to go out and celebrate afterwards. Interesting, interesting choice of behaviour. There was police involvement. There was suggestion of some sexual harassment. Number of players were called off the plane when they're just about to take off to return to Paris the next day. Really, really dire, the whole thing. And this was the new France that was coming together with Jacques Brunel. So the word shambles hardly does it sufficiently, does it? Have they actually gone backwards, if that was possible? Because they've now dropped eight players who played in that team. Most of those eight, I think six of the eight, were involved in the scandalous night out on that Sunday night in Edinburgh. Is that a team that is actually now in reverse?
I think you're probably right, Sotty. I think it's very hard. What France need is for someone to press the stop button for them to start again. But what happens with France is they just compound one shambles with another shambles. And I think Brunel has come in and perhaps dropping seven players, including Teddy Thomas, who has been one of their brightest stars of this championship, is his attempt to to stop the shambles, if you like, stop the rot, press pause on things, and actually relaunch the French team, because to have seven players pulled off an aeroplane and to be questioned, even if ultimately that nothing comes of it legally, just shows a lack of discipline and a lack of respect almost for the position that they're in. I know that the players under the previous regime, under Guy Novès, had completely lost faith in the management. They lost faith that he was modern enough to have a game plan that was evolved enough to compete with a team like England. And they'd effectively stopped playing. I talked to someone when I was down at the World Rugby Awards who'd been involved in that draw with Japan, and it was a sort of a shrug of the shoulders, and you know, they'd lost faith in it. Brunel is trying to start again. We saw that with the selection that he made at the start of the championship. But it, as Eddie Jones would be like here, discipline is everything, and I don't think you'd see seven England players going out on Saturday night to the same extent while they're in an England camp. Eddie Jones just won't stand for it because it's about standards.
Well, that's absolutely true, but we only have to go back a decade to being in New Zealand in 2008 and then being in the World Cup back in that same country, 2011, thank you. And England were a complete rabble. You know, they were jumping off ferries, they were getting in trouble, they were being interviewed by the police. There was, you know, in 2008, there was, you know, concerns about kind of various, best way to phrase it, sexual impropriety or what have you. Nothing was ever proven, but various players were wrapped on the knuckles, pulled over the coals over it. So England have been in this shambolic situation, and it's taken them an awful long time to get to where they are now, because, you know, 2011 was a serious low point before 2015, which was another even lower point.
That was a rugby low point,
as opposed to a behavioural one. And the other thing you say about France, they are a shambles, and yet they should have beaten Ireland. You know, they denied Ireland a try, and this is an Ireland team who we're now talking about as potentially as a Grand Slam team. Yeah. So they can't be completely without merit, but they've got to get their heads in gear. I mean, they're playing Italy at home this Friday. You can imagine Conor O'Shea's relief when he saw the news coming out of France about them all being pulled off trains, etc., planes, because Italy are a team who've got their own problems. But all of a sudden, that game down in Marseille on a Friday night is actually very interesting. You know, Italy will fancy that they can go and do a job over France. They've done it a couple of times, and France have got it all to prove because they are in a mess.
Spinky, just moving back onto the England-Scotland game, one of the things we always talk about, especially in Six Nations, but around rugby, is passion and emotion. And Six Nations has a competition with a great history of rivalries, passionate rivalries. So you lived in Scotland over that 1990 period. How long were you there for?
I was there for 3 years, 89 to almost 93.
So you were in the middle of it. You would have felt you'd have been aware of what Scotland and Scottish rugby people, how they felt towards England and the England rugby team. I have to say, I have a slight stance on this, which is probably wrong. I'm always slightly mystified that so much is built up about this, especially from the England side, because I don't think the England players feel this bitterness that is pushed back at them. I think England used to in the past when they went to Wales, because they felt they were the underdogs then, and they were sick of being beaten then. But I think it's almost all the other way now. Just tell us, when you were in Scotland in those years, especially around 1990, as you said, there was the grudge match, the magnificent, great historical Grand Slam game that Scotland prevailed in. How did it feel like to be around then?
Well, you've got to remember, this was the amateur era. I think professionalism has taken a lot of this away. They still, be it Wales, Scotland or Ireland, before they play England, they still trot out the kind of historical animosity, but it doesn't have the same resonance that it did back then, certainly in 1990. As I say, that was a time of Thatcherism, of a lot of hardship. The poll tax had been brought in. It was trialled in Scotland. And there was a resentment from across the border, from Scotland to England, which went far beyond rugby. But this was the opportunity. This was the kind of a mechanism for the Scots to really unload on England. And through that championship, Scotland had a decent team. England had a very good team. And England went up there with that swagger. Even if they're not confident, they're accused of being arrogant. But there was that sense that there was a bit of arrogance about them. They thought they only had to turn up for that game. And when you talk about, you talk kind of glibly about playing against a nation, and we've seen it, we've been around the world and seen certain occasions where you really feel you're up against a nation. That was one of those occasions. I mean, Murrayfield was just a sea of vitriol and anti-Englishness, and England just never got going. I mean, I was reading some of the press reports from that day afterwards, and the comments that were made were kind of England expected, Scotland delivered. It was that sense of entitlement that England had then. And they've, you know, that lesson takes a lot of learning, because since then they've been back to a few times. As recently as last season, they went to Dublin for a Grand Slam. And we spoke to them the day before here, and they were absolutely 100% sure in their own minds that they were going to win that game. You could tell the way they spoke, you know. And so history and the Celtic fringe have a habit, a repeated habit of catching them with their trousers down.
And do you think, just to bring that, all those themes through to the Calcutta Cup game this Saturday, can Scotland dredge up that kind of emotion and passion that drove them then, or are we in such different times now where the historical context that you put that game in is almost irrelevant?
Yeah, I think we are. I think professionalism has changed it. They will try, but I think they'll probably take more from playing for Doddy Weir, for example, as they did against New Zealand in the autumn. They're probably taking more emotion and passion out of a cause like that, as opposed to, you know, the English are out to get us, and because of things that they did in, you know, Bannockburn and Culloden all those years ago. I don't think that plays big anymore. They will find something, but I don't think it plays that big.
I don't think it plays big between the players, as Spinky says. I think someone was saying before the Wales game that, you know, look at Bath. Bath have got Faletau, and Charteris has been there, and then they're used to playing alongside these players. A lot of them were teammates on the Lions. Where it does play a part, I think, is in the occasion and the atmosphere. And Spinky talked about Ireland last year. You look back 2013. Down in Cardiff, Wales, England. England went there to win the Grand Slam. No one really thought... We thought Wales might deny them the Grand Slam. Nobody thought Wales would go on and win the title because of the points difference. But the occasion was enormous, and England were rocked by it. The noise inside that stadium was like nothing I'd ever experienced for that length of time. I remember watching Mo Farah win golds at 2012, which was spine-tingling, but this was 80 minutes of full-on oral assault, and on the field, Wales fed off it. So I don't think, you know, I don't think there's any hostility between players based on that history, but it whips up a fervour, and that fervour can then have an impact on what happens on the day.
Okay, so the final game of the weekend that we haven't spoken about is Dublin, Ireland against Wales. Ireland will be favourites for that, but Wales will have significant players coming back, probably George North, probably Liam Williams, outside chance of Dan Biggar. That's a considerable change, so three Lions coming back like that. How do you see that one going, Spink?
Normally, when a game is almost too close to call, you go with home advantage. You tend to think that's going to be relevant. I'm kind of fascinated by Wales when Warren Gatland's in charge, because they're a completely different beast to the times when he goes away on his sabbaticals, and indeed most times when they play in the autumn, when they just seem to be kind of revving themselves up for the kind of important part of the season, which is the Six Nations. So this is Gatland's 100th match in charge of Wales. It's a big occasion for him. He's only lost 12 out of 42 matches in the championship in charge, which is a pretty impressive record. Ireland are without Furlong, without Henshaw, two of their, I don't know, top five most influential players, I would have thought Wales have got a chance, definitely got a chance. For the narrative of the championship, we kind of want it to go to an England-Ireland Grand Slam on the final day, so it would be quite nice if that happened, but I wouldn't put any money on Ireland with any confidence.
We started the championship talking about how Ireland held all the aces because they had all the control over their players, so they were all fit. And as Pinky says, now they're losing. They've got significant names out. Sean O'Brien's not there. Furlong might not be there, who's massive for them. He's the rock upon which so much is built. Not only is Robbie Henshaw injured, but so's Gary Ringrose, who made a big impact against England last year. So they've got some questions to answer there selectorially, because they've got some questions to answer now, which they haven't had so far by losing big players. And Wales have almost answered their questions. They've lost so many lines out with the first couple of weekends. And now they're starting to come back, Liam Williams and George North, as we said. And you know, maybe that'll tip the balance a bit, how Ireland can cope with losing big players.
Okay, prediction time. Ireland, Wales. I will have Ireland by 1 point. Spinky?
I will go with a Johnny Sexton penalty to win it.
I'll have Ireland by 5.
Down in Marseille, France entertaining Italy. France, the shambles that we discussed. I think whatever way you put it, France are going to win that. Even though we've slated them, I feel it's just a question of how big is the margin. I'll have France by 15 on that. Spinky?
No, I think it's going to be tighter. I think Italy are due a performance which lasts longer than just a few cameo moments. And I think it will be tighter. I think France will really have to sweat to get through that one.
Yeah, I think France will win, but I can see a scenario whereby Italy, who are not as good a team, but have a much stronger team spirit and dynamic and cohesion, could actually take a grip on proceedings. And then it's about whether some magic from France could put, you know, one of their moments, put a rabbit out of the hat. But I think France will win, but I can see a scenario whereby Italy make it very, very difficult for them.
I'd be surprised if anyone goes anything other than an England win. But I think Scotland will definitely make it a better competition than we've seen in the past. So I will say I'll have England by just more than a score, a tiny bit of comfort.
I think England will win it by 10 to 12 points, but I really want to see Scotland give them a rattle. I want to see Scotland frighten them.
Yeah, I'd say England 15. And my prediction last week was way out because it poured with rain, and that could be a factor on
that. That was unfair on you, wasn't it?
That could be a factor at Murrayfield, obviously.
Do you want to have two predictions then, a sort of losing and a winning version?
I'll still say England by 15 points.
Okay, thanks, gents. Just before we're done, just want to have a moment to reflect on some. Sad news in rugby, the retirement of a very promising up and coming young player, Sam Jones, 26. He hasn't played rugby for 16 months. The last time he was involved at all was when he got called up for an England camp in Brighton, October 2016. That was the big moment, wasn't it? When he sort of been spotted by Eddie Jones, elevated into the England squad, potential England career ahead of him, we thought at the time, and he got badly injured on that occasion. They said at the time it's going to be 5 months. It's now been 16, and he's been forced recently just to concede defeat to the whole thing and has packed it in. That is just one of the very sad realities of the way the game is now, isn't it?
It's terribly sad. It's terribly sad in a time under Eddie Jones when almost everything is going right for England. This is a desperately sad story. I remember talking to Danny Cipriani and a couple of the other boys at WAS at the time when Sam Jones first came through, and they all said without exception that he was just a superb talent and, you know, had a really, really bright future ahead of him. So for him to be kind of cut down before it even got going on the international stage is really tragic.
Yeah, it reminds me, slightly different scenario, but Tom Rees, same position, same club, a young flanker with immense potential, flagged as the answer to a position that England have struggled for a solution for, you know, consistently for many years, and just, you know, Tom Rees got to play for England, but not enough, and Sam Jones never got to play for England, which is a crying shame because he was a hell of a young player.
Okay, gents, listen, thanks very much for joining us today. This is The Ruck, recorded at Pennyhill Park, England's base. We will be all three of us up at Murrayfield for the game at the weekend. The Ruck will be back next weekend. Thank you very much for joining us.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.